Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at mathworks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Rich Cohen's grandfather, Ben, stood up out of the teeming masses of Brooklyn, New York, founded the company that makes Sweet and Low, the sugar substitute in the little pink packets, made millions, and built a fortune. When that fortune got passed on, Rich Cohen and all his wing of the family, mother, father, sister, brother, were completely cut out of the will, 100% disinherited. Now Cohen, a writer for Rolling Stone, is telling the story of his disinheritance and the dirty family laundry behind it with a savage glee. Revenge is all he's likely to ever get, and here it is. Up next on Point, Sugar, Brooklyn, disinheritance, and revenge in the story of Sweet and Low. Joining me from New York, Rich Cohen. He's contributing editor to Rolling Stone magazine. He's written for Harper's and Vanity Fair. His books include Lake Effect and Tough Jews. His latest and most personal is Sweet and Low, A Family Story. Rich Cohen, welcome to On Point.
Great to be here.
Great to have you. You've been telling this story a lot. We're getting lots and lots of millions on the line. You and all of your family cut right out of it. What is it that turns people's heads most about this story when you tell it, Rich?
Well, I think the invention itself, the fact that this guy, my grandfather, was a counterman at a diner, and he didn't like the way the sugar got congealed in the sugar bottles, and ultimately he invented the sugar packet. Such a simple little idea that you don't even think anyone invented it. And then later on, he invented Sweet and Low, something to put in a sugar packet, and it became one of the biggest, sort of weirdest American inventions that gave birth to this great fortune. And it's that thing, that the simple idea can change the world, is like the American dream. And then when you take a normal family, basically normal with a basic dysfunction, and inject a couple $100 million into it, and everyone seems to go completely nuts, and it's like a story of uncles and aunts, and it's like the American dream, and it's going off the rails, or it's the dark side of the American dream.
The fortune that was the at the bottom of all the troubles, you write.
Yeah, the big problem he had with his product was the only sweetener at the time to use in his product was saccharin. And the problem with saccharin was the bitter aftertaste. And it was this thing where it was like a naturally occurring literary symbol for me writing this book, because it was the bitter aftertaste was like the family. It was so sweet at first and then so bitter going away.
There's a great piece just at the beginning, right at the preface, next to the family tree that you outline here, Rich Cohen. We should read for us where you look at everybody's different versions of how the troubles began, what they tap back to. It introduces us to some of the people in your family and gives us a sense of the complexity and kind of wonderment and strangeness of the story behind the disinheritance. I wonder if you could just jump right in and read that for us.
Sure, I'd love to. Everyone in my family tells this story, but everyone starts it in a different way. My mother starts it in the diner across from the Brooklyn Navy Yard, where my grandfather, Benjamin Eisenstadt, a short order cook, invented the sugar packet and Sweet and Low, and with them built the fortune that would be the cause of all the trouble. My sister starts it with his wife, Betty, the power behind the throne, the woman who, in this version, found in Ben a vehicle for her dreams. Whenever anyone asks what Betty was like, I say, Betty had her name legally changed to Betty from Bessie. My father starts the story in downtown Brooklyn, in the courtroom where my Uncle Marvin, the first son of the patriarch, a handsome curly-haired man who insists on being called Uncle Marvelous, is facing off against federal prosecutors. After assuming control of the Cumberland Packing Company, which makes Sweet and Low, Sugar in the Raw, New Salt, and Butter Buds, Marvin, among other things that caused a scandal, put a criminal on the payroll, a reputed associate of the Bonanno crime family. That criminal made illegal campaign contributions to Senator Alphonse D'Amato, who sponsored legislation that kept saccharin on the market. Saccharin, a key ingredient of Sweet and Low, had been found to cause cancer. In the end, Marvin cut a deal with prosecutors, testifying for the government and keeping himself out of prison. In other words, Uncle Marvelous turned rat. I start this story at the Metropolitan Club on Manhattan's Upper East Side, where my cousin Jeffrey, the oldest son of the oldest son, the scion of the third generation, is getting married for the second time. Jeffrey, a burned-out surfer, a bloodshot member of the high school class of 78, whose yearbook picture still tells the story, is earmarked to inherit the empire. If Jeffrey read more widely, he would know that he is fated to screw the pooch, lose his grip, open his hands, and let the money blast back into the whirlwind. Or I start with Uncle Ira, the youngest son of Ben and Betty, a vice president of the company who controls 49% of the stock. Ira, who has always struck me as an extreme eccentric, is years younger than his siblings, a pampered, interesting kid who grew into a genuine nut, a man who carries a purse, wears sandals, follows whims, sports an unruly red beard, and lives in an East Side townhouse with his wife and many cats. Ira has been to his office at the factory just twice in the last 10 years, though he says he works many hours a day from home via phone and fax. He is the trick that fate played on Empire, the inscrutable brother who has to be watched. At Jeff's wedding, he approached me in the bathroom. Standing next to me at the urinal, he said, "What's the last thing you want to hear your crazy uncle say to you in the bathroom?" "What? Nice d-." My brother starts the story in Flatbush, in the icebox chill room of my Aunt Gladys, a woman who, for mysterious reasons, had not been out of the house, her childhood home, where she still lived with Ben and Betty, in almost 30 years. I once heard a politician describe Arrival's tax scheme as the crazy aunt hiding in the attic, and I said to myself, she actually lives on the ground floor. Whenever I asked what was wrong with Aunt Gladys, why she never left her room, words were muttered about arthritis, psoriasis, lack of confidence. Even though she is the least physically active of the Eisenstadt siblings, Gladys, with her telephone, drives the action of this story. In a way I am still trying to fathom, Gladys is its protagonist. When I was briefing my brother-in-law on his new family and told him that Gladys had not left the house since the Nixon administration, he said, "You mean mostly she stays in the house, but now and then she leaves the house to go to the store?" I said, "I mean mostly she stays in her room, but now and then she leaves her room to go to the bathroom."
Rich Cohen reading from his new book, Sweet and Low, A Family Story. And it's quite a story of how his mother, Ellen, the daughter of the patriarch, and all her issue, in the words of the will, were cut right out of the inheritance. It's a big story with a lot about Brooklyn and immigrants and sugar and the sugar industry, all woven in this tapestry. We're going to look at that. But take us to the end here, Rich. I mean, you've got here a cafeteria turned into a factory, sitting there in Brooklyn, churning out millions and millions and millions of these little pink packets we all know, making millions every year, worth hundreds of millions, one presumes. And you, your mom, your brother and sister, all cut out. How did that happen?
Well, to me, it's like thinking about infinity. You know, if you try to think about it too carefully, you can go insane. There's a million reasons, and I can't put my finger on any one of them. I think the reason given at the end, because my brother, who's a lawyer, and my father and mother explored a will contest and actually deposed my Aunt Gladys in that cold room I mentioned. My grandpa Ben was 89 years old. He had a bad heart. He was sick, and he had trouble finding anybody to operate on him. And he asked my mother, because my father had the same surgery. My mother brought him to a doctor. He had the surgery. After the surgery, he developed an infection. He was allergic to antibiotics, which is one of the reasons it was hard to do the surgery. And he died. And my grandmother blamed, or came to blame, my mother for the death of Ben. And as you said, disinherited Ellen and her issue, she said, for reasons I deem sufficient. That's, I guess, the main reason. But otherwise, it gets into immigrant Brooklyn and the whole strange situation of daughters versus sons and fighting over legacy and everything else. My grandma Betty had this weird sort of parenting style I call love is finite, where she believed there was only a certain amount of love in the world to go around. My mother had a very close relationship with her own father, and I think she was jealous of that relationship. and felt that if her husband loved her daughter too much, there wouldn't be enough love left for her. And I think you go straight from there, from that feeling to Ellen and her issue, I leave nothing for reasons I deem sufficient.
Did you grow up thinking you would be rich because you would inherit a significant chunk of this very large family fortune?
I did not, and I don't know why I did not. My parents moved out of Brooklyn before I was born. I was born in Glencoe, Illinois, mm-hmm. in the North Shore of Chicago. Mm-hmm. And I always think of Brooklyn was like this stew. And out of the stew came all these crazy people and came this amazing product and a lot of other things. My father always said that 1 in 5 people have roots in Brooklyn and that you don't need a job when you're from Brooklyn because being from Brooklyn is a full-time job. And I really grew up on the outside. At the beginning of the book, I sort of say I'm like Napoleon looking at Paris from Corsica, you know. I really saw it from the outside. I never expected to get money. It was clear to me that there was something not right about the family. You have an aunt, my aunt, that doesn't leave the house and doesn't leave the house for 30 years.
Literally does not leave the house.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I have my uncle who runs the company who winds up being – the company ends up becoming corrupted, winds up being indicted and confessing to all these crimes. And my other uncle who is almost like a recluse and doesn't leave his house and has all these cats. So I always felt like there was something objectively wrong here and I was – my inheritance, in a way, was to grow up with a normal childhood.
Rich, I wish you'd read something there for us just at the end of the preface about the final chapter in this saga.
Okay. In 1995, when my grandfather collapsed in the hospital, the first relative on the scene was my brother. In a nice twist of fate, Stephen found himself charged with making life and death decisions for the man who had once helped him recognize the unfairness of the world. In the months following Ben's collapse, the family battle moved into its titanic phase, with Ben shuffling from doctor to doctor and everything up for grabs, the money, the legacy, and the story itself. When Grandma Betty died, I found out that my mother had lost this battle and that she and all of her children had been written out of the will. The factory and assets of the company are worth an estimated several $100 million. Betty's last words came in a legal document. I hereby record that I have made no provision under this will for my daughter Ellen and any of Ellen's issue for reasons I deem sufficient. Her issue? It was like being called discharge or refuse or excrement. She swallowed a dime, but it came out in the issue. So fate has placed me in the ideal storytelling position, the youngest son of the once favorite daughter, outside but inside, with just enough of a grudge to sharpen my sensibility. I am Napoleon, staring at Paris from Corsica. All they have left me is this story. To be disinherited is to be set free.
Napoleon staring at Paris from Corsica. Rich Cohen reading from Sweet and Low. Take us back to the beginning of this story. It's a very American story about a very ambitious young man who stood up out of that orphaned immigrant status family and made millions. Describe how it happened.
Well, my grandfather, as you said, was his father died when he was very young. There's a story where he was Jewish and his father was a Jewish immigrant. And his father died in a Catholic hospital. He went to the hospital to give his father a new set of clothes, and he was told by a priest that his father was now with Jesus.
Right.
And he didn't know what that meant. And he went home, and his mother said, "Where's your father?" And he said, "Oh, it's okay. He's with Jesus." And that began sort of his life as fatherless and then ultimately growing up like an orphan. One of the jobs he had was working in a tea bag factory. He ultimately went through high school and he went to law school, St. John's Law School, graduated first in his class and couldn't get a job because it was the Depression. Mm. And he started working in his wife's family's business, which was a diner in Brownsville, Brooklyn, where a lot of the members of Murder Incorporated hung out. That was really the original source of my first book, Tough Jews.
Mm-hmm.
And that was
sort
the world.
Mob types.
Yeah, real old-time mob types. Mm-hmm. And he was ambitious, and he started going to bigger and bigger diners. And ultimately, he bought a cafeteria across the street from the Brooklyn Navy Yard, which, when the Second World War started, became a booming cafeteria because all the soldiers and sailors were coming through his diner. And he, with this money, started to have a family, my Uncle Marvin, my Aunt Gladys, and my mother. And then the war ended and the business ended, and he had no more business, so he had this great idea to buy a tea bag machine because he knew how to bag tea. Mm-hmm. He started making tea. He changed the name from the Cumberland Cafeteria to the Cumberland Packing Company. Nobody bought the tea. He's out of ideas. He's out of money. He has a family to support. He's at a Cookie's Diner in Midwood, Brooklyn, with my grandma Betty. And he's sitting there thinking, what am I going to do? And she's sitting there trying to get the sugar to come out of the bottle to go in her coffee.
We all remember that. The big old, well, maybe we do, of a certain age, the big, big glass bottle of sugar. People would put saltine crackers in it to try to keep it dry enough to flow.
Or little pieces of rice.
Yeah, yeah.
And, you know, she's like, well, you know, why don't you just pack sugar? It was really Grandma Betty who had this idea in a moment of exasperation. Mm. And he went back and he reconfigured his teabag machine to be the first ever sugar packer. He took his idea down the shore because Brooklyn was the center of sugar refining in the whole Western Hemisphere. Mm-hmm. He took it to Domino Sugar. He showed him the idea. They had two questions. How does it work? And did you get a patent? And he didn't. So they wound up making their own machines, and he started packing sugar for smaller companies and packing other things. He packed soy sauce, duck sauce, sea monkeys, if you ever heard of those.
The little things that blow up in water?
Yeah, little like amoeba shrimp you order from the back of comic books.
Right.
And as a kid, it's the first time you realize you've been suckered when you get all excited about them. And
but the little packets in the diner, that's the core invention here. That was his, even though Domino and others stepped in very quickly to deliver the same thing.
That was his, and it's so American because it was so much for him about being clean, about being mm-hmm. sanitary and personal property. You don't have to share this with anybody.
Right,
it's yours.
Right.
And then about 10 years later, working with a pharmaceutical company who had an idea, and my Uncle Marvin, who by then had joined the business, and a scientist that they worked with, they had this idea to invent fake sugar, which did not exist. And they came up with a formula with saccharin as the sweetener, and they invented Sweet and Low. The name Sweet and Low, Grandpa Ben came up with it, was based on the words of a Tennyson poem called Sweet and Low. Mm. Sweet and Low, Wind of the Western Seas. Mm. And the color pink was to stand out in the sugar bowl. And my Aunt Barbara was an artist. She drew the little musical cleft.
Yeah, we all know that.
And mm-hmm. Yeah, and they thought it was going to be a little thing for pharmaceutical company, for drug stores and hospitals for diabetics and people that were morbidly obese. And what they didn't realize is about like half of America after the Second World War had gone on a diet. And they plugged into the zeitgeist, and it went from this little packing company into this $100 million company virtually overnight.
New York Times reviewer said that reading you savage your relatives, you sometimes wonder, are you allowed to do this? We'll talk about that. The book itself may be the best revenge, but a lot of listeners want to join us. Rich, Anna is calling from Augusta, Georgia. Hi, Anna. You're on the air.
Well, hello. I am so sorry about the loss of both of your grandparents. Anytime you have that kind of loss, it's hurtful. I have a good friend of mine in Virginia whose family had a fairly considerable, not nearly as large as yours, sum of money. And her mother had her cut out of the will also. And I'm always amazed. I don't see how children can rectify these feelings of not only the loss of their parent, but than just the whole loss of the whole family unit. I'm not talking about just the monetary, but there is no, it seems like the support is gone. And how is your mother coping with this?
Rich Cohen?
Yeah, well, that's a great point you make, because when I go to my uncle and I would try to talk about it, he would say it's just about money. And the people that saying that are always the ones that have the money. And you try to explain to him, it's not about the money. It's about the things you're talking about. It's about the loss of support, being totally on your own. I always say it's like somebody blew up all the bridges that connected you to your own past, and you're thrown onto your own devices. And that's what I mean by being set free. Being set free is a terrifying thing. It's not a good thing, always, you know. And the fact is that it was, I think, disinheriting somebody is an act of violence, And when you do it right, you do it and then you die, it could never be fixed and it goes through the generations. I have two little sons of my own and I look at them and I think, could I imagine saying yes to one and no to another? It's unbelievable. How does my mother deal with it? It's hard, you know, and she's sort of fragile to begin with. She comes out of the same family, and I think that this book actually has been good because it basically, you know, telling stories helps and saying you can sort of disinherit us from everything else, but you can't disinherit us from the story or tell us we're not who we think we are. And that's what the book is about. So I think also the big thing is realizing that you have your own family to build and try not to make the same mistakes that your parents made.
You know, one thing that comes in here very clearly, Rich, you talk about primogeniture, about the long tradition of things going to the eldest son. You say, watch out, there's no better way to blow up a family when there's a fortune involved. How do you think about that now?
Well, I think that as far as there's the story of the family and there's the story of the business, and it's a lesson to people that own family-owned businesses, which is there was this thing in my family, and it exists in America. One is things go to the oldest, things go to the boys, things stay in the family. And the problem is you very quickly get in sort of interbred family and you get a rich man. Ben might have grown up poor, but he became rich, and his son became the son of a rich man. And by the time you get down to the third generation, which is now, the factory is now being run by my cousin Jeffrey, you have people who think the money will always be there because the money always was there. And ultimately, you lose the factory. You get Splenda and you get Equal because you get first-generation guys coming and competing with third-generation guys. So I think that it's important to realize in this case that in a business, you go where the talent is, regardless of what birth order it is, and you also share, and that like love is infinite, and the more you give, sort of the more comes back. And when you're stingy with these things, it'll destroy the business and destroy the family in the end.
You say love is infinite, but you say that wasn't the view of your grandma Betty, and maybe that's part of the reason that your mother Ellen got cut out. Anna, thanks for your call. Ginger's calling from Boston. Hi, Ginger. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you?
Well, what do you know?
Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I'm the youngest of several children, and my father had disowned three of his children for various reasons.
That's a lot. Three out of how many, Ginger?
Five.
Wow.
Yeah, and it's a very sad family, unfortunately. But they did things that he didn't like or agree with, and somehow they embarrassed him, or they didn't live up to his expectation. And as I got older, my father is elderly and has become very sickly. And one of the things he's always said is, "I don't want them to get anything. I don't want them to get anything." And I just never dealt with it or thought about it. But when it came time to get his finances and everything in place because mm-hmm. he's no longer able, I was put with the task to write them out of the will.
To write your own brothers and sisters out of the will. That was your
yeah.
job.
Well, the job was to make sure that his wishes were honored, and they were that they get nothing. Which, for me, one of the things that has happened is I hadn't talked to them in 30 years. And I had seen a lot of things going on when I was a child that made no sense to me, and they left, and I was kind of back in the madness that I had to grow up with and try to make my own way. So I didn't really have anything to do with them. But the interesting turn is I have recently reunited with one of them, seen my brother, and I have a sister that I'm now in touch with.
And how do they feel about that now that you've got the money and they don't?
Well, my father has not died. He's very sick, and he has, you know, Alzheimer's.
Okay.
But one of the things that I thought about, because I'm put in the position where I have to honor his wishes, and I believe that's my task, whether I agree with them or not, but I also feel that I feel that there's a need for me to somehow do something for them. And one of the dilemmas is, how do I do that? So my thought was when my father dies, and for one of my siblings who will yeah. definitely need help, to maybe set up a trust fund for her.
Right.
So that she has something, and it will be from me, so that it will still be within his wishes. And for the other sibling, who is doing fine financially and all that,
yeah.
to try to do something for, he does have a daughter who I just met, and she's an adult. And he has another daughter who I haven't seen in 40 years.
But it all goes from being kind of an assumption that it will be divided equally to suddenly going to a few and you having it completely as a matter of your discretion whether the others get a piece or not. Rich Cohen, you must be listening closely to this. What do you say?
Right.
I want to ask you, first of all, about Ginger says, I have to honor his wishes. I mean, when it comes to it and there's money in a family, it's going to be passed along. It can start to seem awfully arbitrary at the end. Someone who's old, maybe sick, maybe has Alzheimer's, and they're going to say, you're out, you're in. How do you feel about that honoring the wishes piece?
Well, my situation is a little different because my grandfather did not disinherit us. He just died before my grandmother. My grandmother went into deep mourning and sort of shock and went back to this house where she was alone with my aunt, who was controlling her medication and possibly even abusing her. I thought at one point of calling this a Brooklyn Gothic. And at that point, the will was changed. So I thought it was sort of dubious. As far as the thing that bothered me the most later, and this gets right to the point of your call, is that I went to my uncle, Marvin, and I said to him, why didn't you do something?
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're the older brother. Why didn't you do something? And he said, it was none of my business. And to me, that's like the source of the whole problem. It goes back to, you know, Cain and Abel, you are your brother's keeper. If that's not your business, then really nothing is your business. And this was a situation where this factory, Cumberland Packing, ultimately became sort of loaded up with criminals and possible mobsters. And it was, again, not his business to know what was going on. It was like character equals destiny. But I think what you're talking about is really right here. You're talking about you wanting to do the right thing, but do what your father wants. However, then it puts you in the position of power over your siblings for stuff that really is beyond their control. I think everything should be divided equally, and I personally think that there should be like a much bigger estate tax anyway, so you don't have this continual wealth as power through the generations and this locking up of money. But basically, it sounds like it's not even in your ability to do anything while he's alive. So if you can do something that's the right thing after he dies, then that's what you should do. But you should just do it with as little fingerprints on it as possible.
It has not happened in your family's story. I mean, the fortune went where it went. Uncle Marvin still runs the thing. The fortune is not under any of your fingers. You, your brother, your sister, your mom, it's gone.
Right. And if you go to him and say, he'll say, you weren't disinherited. What do you mean by disinherited? You weren't disinherited. But you got to understand, this is a situation where the guy's in kind of a denial because what happened was so awful that he doesn't want to deal with it.
Phil is calling from Tampa, Florida. Hi, Phil. You're on the air.
What a great bunch of stories. I had to call because in so much of what I'm hearing is so parallel to my own family story. I mean, even down to, you know, you're a Kohen, I'm a Levi. You know, I remember eating a Cookies Diner with my grandmother. You know, there's a lot of parallel.
And did you get cut out, Phil? Was it that tough on you?
Well, I don't think it was anything the amount of money we're talking about here. But my mother, there was an issue with my grandfather's will and an uncle who turned on my mother. And forced a particular vision of the will, and there was a big dispute about it, and it ended up splitting that family. And that family was an interesting group of people who had, in the previous generation from my mother, had gangsters in it, had men who, you know, fathered children and left their wives, and a whole bunch of these sort of the down and out side of the immigrant story, particularly the Jewish American immigrant story. And what I was wondering in this is, how much of this, the way I've come to think of it, is that something in that disruption, something about leaving Russia and coming to America as a group in when they did at the turn of the century, was really disruptive. It really did some damage to them and left a lot of really broken people with a lot of difficulty with connection. And I'm wondering, does that resonate at all with Rich Cohen's story? Is that something that you think is going on at all?
It sounds right in the sweet spot. Rich, what do you say?
Yeah, I think that it's really an immigrant story, and it is amazing how many people have similar stories. And it's the bad part that you're talking about, the breakup of the family and the sort of eccentricity, probably comes out of the fact that you're in the new world where some people are getting very rich and some people are getting left behind. Some people are making it and some people aren't. And that leads to all kinds of jealousy and everything else that you're talking about. But on the other hand, the good stuff also comes from the same thing. Something so optimistic about America in this story is that the guy with the little diner, the guy behind the counter at the diner, has a great idea and it changes the world. However, I always felt really that it was about immigrants only in that here were a lot of people that were immigrants that were in Brooklyn that were starving themselves to look more American, to look like the women in the ads. Mm-hmm. The first diet scale came from Brooklyn. It was some brothers who sold scales to pushcart operators, and the wives of the pushcart operators started asking if they could sit on the scales because they were trying to lose weight. So
the idea of not having that 15 calories in a teaspoonful of sugar and having Sweet and Low instead was appealing.
Yeah, it was just a way to lose weight. Now, you ask yourself, my grandfather invented this in 1958, and here we are in 2006. Are Americans today skinnier and more fit on whole than they were in 1958? So there's something sort of artificial about the whole thing, but it really came out of this longing for the American dream. To me, it was an American dream story, and what you're talking about is the flip side, which is the nightmare. And it's not talked about as much, but it's what makes the story real.
Phil's family from Russia, yours from Poland. There's a bit on page 27. Our time grows short, but maybe if you could start with, what did Betty see in Ben? It speaks to both your grandmother's iron will, ultimately expressed in that will that cut you out, and to the fear that rode behind this experience. This is talking about her early days when she spotted him, when she connected with your grandfather, Ben. Could you read that for us?
Sure. What did Betty see in Ben? What got him cast in the big show? Was it because he was a lawyer and wore a suit and carried a briefcase? Or was it the void in him, the emptiness of the orphan? He had no compass, no direction. Betty could guide him. Betty could teach him. Betty was a Lady Macbethstein, plotting and planning, not among the Scottish royals on the bluffs and the moors, but among the Jewish proletariat, in the steamy walk-ups and Sabbath dinners of immigrant Brooklyn. Fear was the fire at her back, fogging the windows and burning in the rear view. No matter how fast or far she drove, she could never get clear of it. Betty wanted a pile of money to protect her from shame and disaster. She called this a lump sum. She said, "If I just had a lump sum." She was the squirrel that cannot stop hoarding, that gathers beyond what it can ever consume. Jewelry and furs, the coats she wore only once. With a lump sum, she would finally have enough to pay the border guards when it came time to flee.
There's something of the Jewish experience ending up in this land of opportunity. Rich Cohen sits in quite a spot watching how all that unfolded. It unfolded on him and his generation. Phil, thanks for your call from Tampa. Charles is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Charles, you're on the air.
Thank you for your time. Rich, it's a very compelling story. I'm sorry you had to go through it. My question is a little bit about my background. I am the youngest of six. I have five older sisters. The majority of us, or several of us, have been very successful. And then there's two, one in particular, whose life, especially as she's gotten a little bit older, has been marred in drug abuse.
Mm-hmm.
Drug use, accidents, DUIs, stolen pills—your typical drug and alcohol addictive story.
So is she on the road to being cut out, Charles?
Well, that's the concern. Is right now, I think my parents. And again, it's nothing like your family's, but I mean, we're looking at maybe $5-10 million net worth, and split six ways. I think their concern at this point is that, you know, this one in particular and another, if they aren't cut out, then it's going to lead to their demise any faster, faster than they may be headed there on their own.
And how do you feel about it, that your sister should get the money or not?
You know what, I have mixed emotions on it. She, you know, obviously when you have an individual, actually two individuals like this in your family, it's really polarized our family, and just seeing how much pain it's caused for my parents, I have mixed emotions on it. But I think I'm leaning more towards the side that they're going to do more harm to themselves if they are included in the inheritance as opposed to if they are not.
Rich Cohen, it's a call-in show, so you get placed in the place of a therapist and advisor here. What do you think about this story, the idea of judging siblings on whether they should share in the inheritance or not based on how they've lived their lives?
I guess that there's probably, that's your situation. I guess there's probably ways to set up trusts and to protect the money until she's more able to use it and not have it cause her more problems. That would be my suggestion. I know that my, you know, there was a situation with my aunt where money was put in trust for her because she was ill. And I think that the thing is, my belief, and I'm the youngest, and this is where this belief comes from too, is that money should be divided equally and that money should not be used to control. And but by the same token, you don't want to like throw fuel on a fire, if that's what you're talking about. And there are ways to do it legally to set it up. It's interesting that you say that your story is so different than mine, and it is, but it isn't. These are all the same story, you know. They're all stories about human nature and about fathers and children and the blessing. And part of it isn't just the money. And you can ask anybody that's involved if it's about the money. It's about the blessing and about getting something that the parent worked for, that the parent, you get part of the blessing. You're included. You're inside. You're the, that's the blessing of the parent in some way in our society. And to cut somebody out, even for their own good, you don't realize it, but it's to cut them out of their own parents' blessing. So I would say protect it, protect them, but don't cut them out of the blessing.
Charles, thanks for your call. Rich Cohen, I've got to ask you now, when you go into a coffee shop or anywhere and you want something sweet in your coffee and you see those packs all sitting there, of course, Sweet and Low isn't the only artificial sweetener anymore. There's, I can't even keep track, Equal and Splenda. And do you reach for the pink packet? Do you avoid it? Do you go for straight old sugar?
I go for straight old sugar, basically, but I don't have any animosity towards any of these people or towards the product. I hope the product does well, and I hope the factory survives, even with Splenda and Equal. I see it as my grandfather's legacy. I was cut out of it, but hopefully by writing the story of it, I brought myself back into it. And in some way, that little pink packet is a totem of this man and all his ambitions and dreams. And I always like to imagine when I open it and pour out the Sweet and Low that a little miniature Grandpa Ben and Uncle Marvin are coming out and splashing into my coffee.
It's not written in revenge, and yet you're awfully tough. Your cousin Jeffrey there, fated to screw the pooch, lose his grip, open his hands, and let the money blast back into the whirlwind. I mean, again and again, you've got a great light and often funny touch, but it's savage at the same time. The book does feel like revenge, is it?
Look, somebody else can judge if it's revenge. I don't think it's revenge. I think it's the truth. And I went and I interviewed all these people and I spoke to them. And the reason why I hope that it resonates and it's good is because it's honest and it's truthful. And it's written that way because there's no strings attached to me and there's no one controlling me. And the fact is that it's a three-generation paradigm of a business. A patriarch builds it. The second generation, which is my uncle, tries to conserve it. And he does things like make illegal campaign contributions to Senator Alphonse D'Amato, which is something that they did. And the third generation loses it. That's the paradigm. And the reason is because the third generation always grew up in wealth and thinks the money will always be there because it always has been. And then all of a sudden you get Splenda and you get Equal, and it's run by these first generation guys that tear them up. And I thought that there was a model. You could read this book and find out how not to run a family company and how not to deal with your legacy after you're dead. And it's true that there's this book and there's maybe some tough parts in it, but before there was the book, there was the will.
Is the family cracked forever? Split?
I don't know. I don't say forever, and anything can happen. And if things got better, that would be the greatest thing in the world. And these things should all be fixed. But basically, I think that the violence is so great from a disinheritance that it's hard for any family to recover from that.
Well, it's a terrific book, a terrific story, very well told, with a lot more about sugar and Brooklyn and culture. Rich Cohen, I don't know what the other side of the family thinks of it, but as a reader, it's a great read, and we thank you for sharing with us a real inside look. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. I love this show.
Rich Cohen, author of Sweet and Low, A Family Story. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.